Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, Shireen Awad has a brief remembrance of Kenny Rogers, who passed away in March of this year. We'll also hear from Anson Williams, speaking about his campaign against drowsy driving, his book, and, of course, Happy Days. We are starting with Emmanuel Rogers, checking out some thriller fiction set in the world of genetically modified foods.
Joining us today is author Richard Lieberman. Richard is here to speak with us today about his new book, Bad Seed. Thank you for joining us today, Richard.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Emmanuel.
You are welcome. I am really excited to talk to you. I don't know how much conversation we have about the subject matter of your book, Bad Seed, but it is great to be able to talk with someone who has learned so much about it and willing to share in this novel. So again, thank you. Richard, your book is a story about a scientist, a young woman, who genetically engineers food for the masses. What compelled you to write this book?
You know, I got interested in this brand new technology called CRISPR.
Yes.
That allows the transplant of DNA from one organism, you know, plant or animal, into another. And you can do it really quickly and cheaply and kind of changes everything. And I was going to write it as a nonfiction book.
Okay.
But as I got into the subject matter, there were so many issues in terms of the legal, moral, ethical issues and the science, which is like science fiction. I thought it would make a great topic for a novel.
Yeah.
So the book, Bad Seed, is the first novel to base its plot on genetic engineering
Yes.
in the food industry. And it's a thriller involving this, you know, beautiful, brilliant young woman research scientist. It follows her rise from a penniless student to a, I guess, a potentially psychopathic Silicon Valley billionaire.
Yeah.
And although it's fiction, I tried to be as factually accurate in describing the science around bioengineering, particularly
right.
this CRISPR tool, so that we'll both hopefully educate the folks who read it, but also have a very exciting story.
Now, I'm going to come back to CRISPR because that's something that is very interesting there. But what is Aurora's role in this story, and why is it so important for your readers to have an understanding of what she is doing?
Well, I tried to create a complex protagonist. This is a young woman who, you know, is insecure and poor
Yes.
but brilliant, and stumbles across this scientific breakthrough and works her way into great fame and fortune and almost iconic status. And I tell the story from a first-person perspective. And I think readers will find her to be very, very fascinating. And she's neither a hero nor a villain, but a little bit of both, very
Yeah.
complex person. And, you know, as a lawyer, I dealt with a lot of people in corporate America. And, of course, you know, when you write fiction, your fiction is informed by your own experiences. And some of those experiences came into this character, this very intriguing character.
Yeah, because this character, though her role is fiction, there are real people doing exactly what you wrote about in this book right now today. And how is it that they're doing so much that we don't know about?
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, there's this real life case of Elizabeth Holmes, the Theranos blood testing device scandal. It's currently in the news.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big fraud by this also young Silicon Valley woman. And there are some real life similarities between my book and her situation, some, a lot of dissimilarities as well.
Yes.
But, you know, among other things, it raises the issue of how an appealing, charming person, in both cases women, could raise hundreds of millions of dollars from investors for scientific companies where the investors have no understanding of what the science is.
Wow.
To what extent these companies are fueled by money where, you know, the judgment calls may not be made based on real knowledge. Also, in both cases, the difference is the real life Elizabeth Holmes involved deceit and fraud. In my book, we deal with the unintended consequences of well-meaning scientific work. you know, what's going to happen where people are trying to do the right thing, but it goes awry.
It does. But you really did make Aurora human. That's one of the great things about this, because you also put in here a little problem that she has with pills. And that is something that so many of us, either we're personally touched or we know someone, so we are personally touched by their situation. How does one become rich and just let themselves go to doing the things that harm them more than anything else?
Well, I think, you know, and this is universal, great wealth and the ability to have anything you want leads to great temptations. And I tried, you know, in the story to make the reader understand, and a lot of the stories in first person, how someone who's highly intelligent and trying to do the right thing, you know, can make mistakes that have terrible, terrible consequences. How easy it is for that to occur and to make the reader empathize with that.
Right. And again, just on the basic part, she is human. So her greed, her avarice, her arrogance, all of these things that come through at different points are the things that we all face. So I appreciate how clearly you put that in there.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You are welcome. Now, for some time, we have been hearing and talking about modified foods, but we really don't know what is being modified, what's being put in, what's being taken out. You have done a great deal of research. So what are some of the good things that's coming about because of this? And what are some of the drawbacks of the same?
Here are a couple of examples in terms of both the good and bad.
Okay.
Here's a negative. There's a Chinese scientist who, undercover, rogue scientist, used CRISPR to genetically modify real human embryos, twin girls,
right,
to make them resistant to their father's HIV and to alter their intellectual abilities. This guy was caught and condemned, but it shows the adverse ramifications, the negative, of people using this powerful technology to do bad things. On the other hand, there's work in the United States going on in terms of modifying pig organs for human transplant.
Right.
Every year, thousands of people die in the U.S. waiting for transplants because there aren't enough human organs. And scientists have long desired to find a replacement, and they're working now with pig organs, which are very much like ours.
Yes.
But have viruses that have rendered them useless in the past. They're using CRISPR to get rid of those viruses and make these organs available. This would have an, you know, tremendous effect in terms of saving lives. So there are a couple of examples of both, you know, both the positives and the negatives with this new bioengineering advance.
Right. Now, you raised another question for me, but before we get to that, Richard, will you take a moment to share with our audience where they can find out more information about your book, Bad Seed?
Well, Bad Seed is available today on Amazon. Look for Bad Seed by Richard Lieberman. Richard Lieberman, don't confuse it with The Bad Seed, which is an
yes.
old movie. The Bad Seed by Richard Lieberman, yeah. And it also will be in bookstores in May. So it's available today on Amazon, bookstores in May.
Yeah, yeah, and I would stress that to the audience because as I did my research, I had to go through a few things there as far as people named Lieberman and Bad Seed and The Bad Seed. So Bad Seed is the book. You raised a question for me when you brought up the scientist in China. What were some of the things that happened because of these modifications? What happened to the twins?
Well, you know, we don't know because China is not exactly transparent
right.
about what's going on over there. But I'm sure it'll come out eventually. But then, you know, the notion, once you change an embryo who becomes a person, it's out there. The DNA, the procreation of that person, and that is true with plants as well. And that's one of the truly alarming elements of genetic modification of any sort. It's not a one-off.
Right. Now, in Aurora's case, as you said, she was poor. She went to school. She didn't have money coming in from her parents or anything else. And she worked hard because she was intelligent. But this may seem like an obvious question. What does money have to do with your main character's motivations as they're shown in the real world today? Is there a lot of money in modifications?
Well, there is going to be a fortune in terms of the products, both agricultural and medical, that will be created using this technology. You're going to see a lot of funding. with startups and big companies doing as well. So this is huge economic consequence, as well as a big consequence in terms of the effect on people from a medical and food perspective. But, in terms of Aurora and her motivation, and I think this is so true of, many people who are successful in business, their motivation after a while is not money. Success in business, running a big company, it is almost like a drug, and it becomes one's sole focus for living. And I think in many ways, Aurora somehow typifies, many entrepreneurs yes. and CEOs of big companies. It's the immersion in the process that drives them forward.
Okay, now is there also a bit of, we don't want to lose the ground or money that we have going on there?
Well, sure. Nobody wants to go from extreme wealth to poverty. But, in the book, there's a section where her company, there's a takeover attempt on her company, mm-hmm. and she stands to realize, billions of dollars.
Right.
And yet, she fights the takeover attempt because, as she puts it, this business is her life. Without the business, she feels she doesn't, exist as a full person. I think that's a very universal feeling among the folks in this tiny little category of very wealthy people who have gone from nothing to incredible success.
Well, now your book, it brings up so many questions. I have many more than I have time to ask you today. But one of those questions are the ethical concerns. What are the ethical concerns today about gene modifying, splicing, and all in, especially in food?
Well, the government, our federal government,
yeah.
is not really regulating GMOs, even with the new CRISPR. They're basically leaving it to agriculture to do what they think is correct.
Oh, wow.
And it's a complicated issue because the government rightly recognizes this economic benefit of genetic engineering on making cheaper food, more efficient agricultural production. It's been very, very important in the United States and worldwide. But now with this CRISPR technology where basically anybody can modify food, there's no control. As much as we've criticized the big companies, at least with them, there was some transparency.
Yes.
Because they were spending millions of dollars. They were public companies. You could see what they were doing. They'd get sued. If you're working out of your basement and creating a new mushroom or something mm-hmm. that turns out to be lethal, and it gets out there into the food chain, devastating effects. So it's a whole new ball game, and I think one of the purposes of my book is to bring that debate forward so that, the public can engage in it a bit more than they have.
And I hope that that really does work, because these modifications have been going on for some time, and not many of us actually know what we're actually consuming when we bring our groceries home these days. So I hope that that works. And you actually answered a question for me that I had for you, because I really wanted to know, as you wrote this book, what did you hope that people would come away with? And as I understand it, you hope they gain a better understanding of what's going on.
Well, that was my principal goal. And of course, I also hope to write an entertaining book
yes.
that, people thought was a literary piece. And I hope when readers go through it, they feel that way.
I think you've succeeded. I really do. As I read the book, I think you've succeeded. But you raised so many questions about what's going on here. So our government, they're not really involved. And you said someone can do this in their basement?
Absolutely right. Yeah,
wow.
With a few thousand dollars and just a very, very basic understanding of genetic engineering, you can do all kinds of things with this CRISPR tool. That's the scary thing.
Wow. Well, I think I'm going to go buy a CRISPR and see if I can get my pork back to the way it was before they started monkeying with it.
When you do, please invite me over for dinner. I'd be delighted to come.
I would be glad to. Now, I want our audience to understand, this book, Bad Seed, it is a good read. It really is. It has a lot of intrigue and a lot of human connections here that we all have, that we can all understand. But it raises so many questions about what's going on in our food that I really want to thank you, Richard, for sharing this information with us. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Well, I did too, and thank you so much for having me, Emmanuel.
You are welcome, sir.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with author Richard Lieberman. His book, Bad Seed, can be found at many bookstores and online retailers. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear from Shireen Awad with a brief remembrance of Kenny Rogers, who passed away in March of this year. First, though...
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums, ready to race to you. These days are ours.
Happy
days. These days are ours. Share them with me.
Lillian Vasquez spoke recently with Anson Williams, probably best known for his role as Potsy on Happy Days. We'll hear about the phrase jumping the shark, but also the phrase singing to the bulldog. You familiar with that one? We'll hear about this, his book, as well as his campaign against drowsy driving. We'll start, though, with Anson Williams' actual name and a very famous relative who's responsible for many lives saved.
Happy days, Saturday, what a day, grooving all week with you.
My guest is actor, director, singer, and entrepreneur Anson Williams. Oh my, welcome to Lifestyles. How exciting to be speaking with you.
And excited to be speaking with you too.
You know, it's kind of cool to be talking to Potsy Weber, and I want to talk about the Happy Days. Your given name is Anson William Heimlich. Did Heimlich not good on the billing or for an up-and-coming actor?
Pretty much. My middle name was William, right? And this is before my uncle. He's my second cousin, but I've called him uncle ever since I was born. An agent said, you got to change the name. Take your middle name and put it in an S. I went, all right. So, yeah. And then Heimlich becomes one of the most famous names in the world, right?
Exactly. But I guess it's easier to spell Williams for sure.
Yeah. If I had my druthers, I'd have kept Heimlich.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I never felt quite right that you don't use your real name.
Mm.
Oh, because it's not markable enough. I always admired Henry Winkler. He kept his name and he made it hip. He made it important. I always felt bad that I changed it. But oh well.
What are you going to do now, right?
Well, I could change it back. I don't think my daughters would like it very much.
As a young girl, a teenager, I used to watch Love American Style. And I remember the Happy Days episode. Is this where Happy Days derived from? And I think it was with you, Ron Howard, and Marion Ross.
Right. There was a different Joni. There was a different father. Yeah, Harold Gould played it. There was no Fonzie. There was no Ralph. It was a different type of show. If you remember, it was a much softer show. It really wasn't made Love American Style. It was a pilot.
Oh.
And then they aired on Love America as part of their programming because you get the money back. But that was an official pilot for Happy Days. It just didn't sell. Everyone was for sure it would sell, and it didn't sell. I went back to my concerned boyfriend parts. You know, it was a living. A year later, American Graffiti had come out.
Right.
And with big hit, and Grease was on Broadway, big hit. And ABC thought, maybe we should look at this again. But this time, let's make it more edgier, like Graffiti. Let's broaden this out a little bit. Let's bring in the music. It was still Happy Days, you know, a little more of a Graffiti tone. This time, Harold Gould wasn't available, and they cast Tom Bosley. Marion Ross was in it. I was doing a film outside of San Francisco in Tiburon called Lisa Bright and Dark. I played Kay Lenz's boyfriend. It was a big deal at the time. It was a famous book. And
I remember it.
It was a big Hallmark movie on NBC. The girl playing Kaylin's sister was Erin Moran. They were looking for a new Joni, and you know, I didn't get her the part, but I recommended her. They auditioned her and signed her to the show. And then a little character by the name of Fonzie came on. And people used to ask me, aren't you jealous of Fonzie? And I said, are you kidding me? He bought me a house. Are you crazy? I'm hanging on to his coattails, man. And he's also the nicest guy. Actually, Don Most auditioned for Potsy. He didn't get it, but they liked him so much, they created Ralph for him.
Ah, Ralph Malph.
Yeah. And this time, we did the pilot. It sold, and the rest is history.
It's funny where you say it was a little edgier compared to today's time. I wouldn't mind having that little edgier back just the way it was, but compared to today's time,
it's... Oh, my gosh.
It's Twinkies.
Remember in the pilot, there was a bra around the radiator, and Fonzie came in and unsnapped it with just a little, right?
Right.
Oh, the letters, man. Oh, God is going to kill us. Hell is descending upon us.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, pretty innocent. But I'm just saying how times have changed.
Oh, boy, have they.
Way different time.
I'll say. You were all going to Jefferson High School. How old were you guys in the series?
As young as we could get.
But you weren't 16, 17, and 18, were you?
Oh, no. Well, actually, Ron was 18.
Okay.
And I'm like almost 5 years older. And Don is about 4 years younger. Henry's like 3 or 4 years older. So I was 23 when it started.
Mm. Playing a kid in high school. You were in high school an awfully long time.
A long time. I was just stupid. I couldn't get out of that place.
The director was Gary Marshall. And I'm wondering...
No, the director was Jerry Parrott.
I'm sorry, right. From Dick Van Dyke era, right?
Yeah, yeah, he won 6 Emmys or 4 Emmys. He played the next door neighbor of Jerry the Dentist.
Yes,
and,
of course.
What a PhD in comedy we got from that man. PhD in comedy. But Gary Marshall, who was our boss and creator of the show, he inspired us all to learn many parts of the entertainment business. Mm. He says, that's how you're going to last. Don't just be actors, especially you, Anson. And he opened up the whole studio for us like a college. I wanted to be a producer-director. And in fact, Ron Howard and I wrote the film. He directed it. It was called Skyward with Bette Davis. That was our first project. So I learned a lot from Ron. I was right next to Polanski when he was directing Chinatown on the back lot.
Oh.
I was right next to John Schlesinger when he was doing Day of the Locust. I was watching all the Grease dance numbers being shot. So I had, you know, just firsthand education with the best professionals in the world. We just all took advantage of and educated ourselves.
So then Gary very much was a mentor to you and the others?
Oh, yes. There's thousands of people that have careers because of him and continue to have careers because of him.
He seemed like a gem, and apparently he was. Actors often say, we were just like family. But from all accounts, your cast really looked like they were close. Were they?
Very close. But again, that was Gary, because you get all these young guys, think the egos and the competitiveness would show its ugly head. But it never did. We were always collaborators. Henry, as big as he got, never put it in anyone's face. Ron was the consummate pro. We all followed suit. And then Gary made sure he created a softball team. We were all ex-athletes. I really think Gary is more concerned about the softball team than the show. He just loved baseball.
So tell me about that softball team. You traveled all over, didn't
you? Well, yeah. We ended up playing in every major stadium in the United States as a pregame. Like, we play against professional football team. We play against the media of that area, whatever. We would do a charity game, Yankee Stadium, Brewer Stadium, Dodger Stadium,
wow,
everywhere in the country. And then we would go all around the world playing against USO tours, playing against the Marines, Army, Navy, Air Force. And we would go all over the world doing these games. And Gary felt that if we're a team, you always back your teammates. And he was right. And people ask, what are your best memories from Happy Days? They're not on the set. They're on these trips that you can't duplicate. This you could never do again in life, these special, special moments of time as a team together all over the world. It made us tighter and closer and more collaborative. It was an amazing, one-of-a-kind experience.
For what position did you play?
First base when Gary got tired, and then I would play mostly like middle field.
And who was pitching?
Henry was pitching.
Ah, and was it softball?
Yeah, and you know what's funny with the USO? And we played in Germany all over. We played in Japan, Okinawa, against really big teams. We never lost the game.
You stayed with the series for 11 years when some of the others were leaving. Why did you decide to stay?
Ron left because he just got this tremendous, tremendous directing deal that ABC wouldn't give him, and he made the right choice. Don left, and who's one of my best friends today, and we live like 20 minutes away from each other. He wanted to do other things. He just got tired of, he said, being typed. And I said, Don, you're typed. I said, even if you're not on, you're on 5 days a week during the day. You're typed.
Right.
But he made the choice to leave. And me, I didn't really care about further acting career. I was way behind the camera by that time. So I just cared about writing and directing and all that. So to me, it was just a godsend to have the show.
So after Happy Days, and even during Happy Days, I guess, you did go behind the camera as a director, and you went on to direct so many other things. And and it's like you stated, you probably got your skills right there on the set of Happy Days, working with other directors. So you were comfortable the first time you went behind the camera?
Yeah, I was very comfortable. Because believe it or not, I started producing while I was on Happy Days. I didn't start directing till a year after. I had attached myself to shows I created and sold. So no one gave me a break. I had to literally create my own breaks for the first two films. No, I felt very confident, very good. Because, I mean, I had, you know, years in front of the camera and years of watching people behind the camera. Going in, I had a lot of experience of working education.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is actor, director, singer, entrepreneur, and author Anson Williams. You wrote Singing to a Bulldog, From Happy Days to Hollywood Director, and The Unlikely Mentor Who Got Me There. In 2014, you wrote this book, and you talk about one of your mentors, Willie.
Yeah, Willie Turner. That's why I say never judge where you're going to get your answers to help your life. It's going to be someone way outside the box. And mine wasn't a billionaire, not a movie star. It was a head janitor at Leonard's department store who was African-American, not well-educated, functioning alcoholic, but a prophet. And I was 15 and a half years old. I grew up, it was a harsh upbringing because my dad was out of World War II, and it was just a different time. So I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself at all. I didn't know who I was, what I was good at, kind of just a kite in the wind. I got a job as assistant janitor at Leonard's department store a few days a week, and Willie Turner was my boss. And he called the janitorial room the talk room. And there were two oil drum cans in there, and you'd sit there and talk. And he was the first adult that talked to me, not at me. And that man turned my life around.
Really?
He took the time to know me. He took the time to find what I was good at. He took the time to give me confidence and inspiration. By the time I left that job, I knew who I was and where I was going. And I never could thank him because, you know, I'm this kid. When I was 19, he had passed away. But he's in my heart. So as far as the book, it's not really a memoir. I mean, because I have all these crazy stories in it, all these crazy true Forrest Gump stories where, you know, I'm at the White House and I'm kidnapped by the President of the United States' daughter to a Harold Melvin and the Blue Knots concert. I mean, he can't make that up. You know, I meet Elvis Presley in a parking lot in Monroe, Louisiana. I mean, on and on. But take those stories, but they always are incorporated into a bigger story. A takeaway that people can bring into their own lives. And that's Willie Turner. You know, I always go back to the talk room with Willie. And there's always a life lesson with every story. I wanted to give people the same opportunity I did to have the wisdom of Willie Turner and to be able to sit on that oil drum and be able to have the same opportunities I did. And that's Singing to a Bulldog. And the reason it's called Singing to a Bulldog, it's interesting because the first time I was able to sing on Happy Days, I convinced Gary. We needed a band on the show because you didn't make money back then like you did today.
Right.
And I've always been one to look for opportunity, not complain. And I thought if I could convince Gary to put a band on the show and I sung on the show, I could get a record contract and I could get booked and I could make money.
Did you know you could sing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I knew I could sing. I'd done a bunch of musicals and things like that. I found him. I said, Gary, can I talk to you? He says, I'm busy. Talk later. I said, it'll only take a minute. He said, walk with me. Walk with me. So I had 60 seconds to sell him. I said, you got girls on the show, you got cars on the show. You need music. You need a band in Arnold's. I sing. Wait, a band? You sing? Yeah. He goes, oh, Richie, a band. Oh my! And literally, he says, I like it. He says, you good? I go, I'm good. He goes, all right, go talk to Bobby. Pick a song. There's a show coming up. I'm going to fit it in. I'm walking away thinking, I just changed my life. I'm going to sing on national television. This is it. Then I hear from the distance, but you're singing to a bulldog. I go, what? You're singing to a bulldog like Elvis. He said, this way. He says, I believe you're good. I don't have time to listen. But if you're good, I'll get a laugh. If you're bad, I'll get a laugh. You're singing to a bulldog. So there I was, first time on national television. And you can look it up on YouTube. Singing to a bulldog. Anyway, he liked it. He liked it. I started singing like maybe every third show. And singing to that bulldog started my way up the mountain to sign a record contract. And to have a tremendous singing career for over a decade.
A one, two, three, and...
So, Jump the Shark is just the opposite. Jump the Shark is at the tipping point when you're on your way down. And Singing the Bulldog is the point where you're on your way up. And that's the reason for the title.
Wow, that's great.
I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, hey. Hands are shaky and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you thank when you have such luck? I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, hey, hey.
That's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Anson Williams. You're listening to KVCR on 91.9 FM, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. More with Anson Williams just ahead. Later in the program, Shereen Awad remembers Kenny Rogers, who passed away earlier this year.
I want to just read this. You had a couple of reviews for your book that I want to share. Singing to a Bulldog is such a meaningful, fun, and uplifting book. I have such sweet memories of Anson, like millions of others. I loved him on Happy Days, and I'm proud to be a little part of this wonderfully written, revealing, informative, and entertaining book. Praise and congratulations to Anson, author Dolly Parton. I have another one.
Yeah.
I've always known Anson to be a great storyteller, as well as a true and generous friend. Now he's written the most important story of his life about Willie Turner, the head janitor of one of Anson's first jobs, whose words of wisdom guided him through a turbulent time in his life and gave him the confidence to move forward to a successful career as an actor, television director, and entrepreneur. Even better, he's made it into a truly inspirational book of life lessons for the rest of us, author Ron Howard. That's some pretty big praise from some pretty big people in the industry.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Yeah. It really was.
Means a lot.
So,
means a lot.
Obviously, Jumping the Shark came from Happy Days. What does it mean?
Jump the Shark means you're at the tipping point where you're on your way down. But here's the thing. It was because of the Fonzie episode when he jumped the shark.
Right, I remember it.
They thought it was so stupid, you know, we're on our way down. And then some guy created Jump the Shark and then put a little website up. The thing is, we were on another 5 years after that, so we didn't exactly jump the shark, right?
Right.
However, the guy that created the website, Jump the Shark, maybe 10 years, he sold the website to TV Guide for $10 million.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty smart guy.
Yeah. You talked about singing. I did read somewhere that you went on to sing in Vegas, and you filled in for none other than Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah, it was the Harris Reno. Yeah, man. And guess who I was co-billed with?
Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby. I remember that, too.
Don't go there.
But let's just talk about the singing experience that it was for you.
It was great. I mean, it was really, that was an amazing experience to be able to finally get to the big room. That was great. And it was Sammy Davis Jr. It's like, where's Dean? Where's Frank? Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like part of the Rat Pack. Then I did Resorts International with Lola Falana. At that point, I knew it was it. I knew I'd run out of steam in a singing career. I've gone as far as I could go. You have to know when it's too wide a river. And I was already getting behind the camera, and I thought, I'm not talented enough to go any further. This is it. They were actually negotiating the Sahara Hotel in Vegas, and I had them cancel it. And my last show at Resorts was my last show, and I went back totally behind the camera.
What was your style of music? What did you sing?
God, it was a real potpourri of stuff. I mean, everything from Jolson to, you know, hit songs of the day, a lot of Happy Day stuff. It was a very assorted kind of show with themes. You know, it'd be a lady theme, an Al Jolson theme, a Happy Days theme. But I had to work hard because even though I recorded records, none of them really became huge hits.
Right.
And it's so funny, when I opened the show, I said, you know, I am the luckiest guy in the world. I don't have any hit records. I can sing whatever I want.
That's good. Let me introduce you again. My guest is Anson Williams, actor, singer, director, entrepreneur, author. The list of credits goes on and on. Anson, is Happy Days still on somewhere in the world? Are you still recognized as Potsy some 40-some years later?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, not as much. Yeah, but there's still a recognition factor. I think it's on MeTV. I mean, it's all over various channels. I think there's rumors. The thing about Happy Days, it was always old.
Right.
So it's always new.
Right.
It's always current. So I'm hearing rumors that CBS streaming, they're going to do a big deal with it again. Because years ago, it got kind of mild, and then TV Land decided to do a whole thing, and there we were again, and like as big as ever. You never know. It's one of those shows that it's pretty much going to be there for generations to come.
Thank goodness. I'm wondering if I can put you on the spot now. If you can, and off the top of your head, recall maybe a story of, you know, working on the set or working with maybe Ron Howard or Henry or Donnie Most, or Marion Ross, Tom Bosley, or Aaron Moran. Can I put you on the spot for a story of one or two of them, if you have that?
I'm saying most of our great moments were off the show. The one thing people don't realize, the moments I really loved, also, everyone's wondering, oh, these world-famous actors, what do they do at the oh, my God, or do they have these glorious trailers? Or, oh, it must be so gorgeous on the Paramount lot. Well, it wasn't. We had the same crappy dressing rooms, you know. forever. And the big deal was Gary put up a hoop basket outside stage 19, and we had the greatest times shooting hoops. You know, Ron and I, or Don, shooting hoops and talking. Shooting hoops and just being guys, you know? Those were very special times.
We often hear that Henry Winkler is noted as the nicest guy in Hollywood. Is he?
Very much so. He's a very selfless guy. I mean, with the amount of fame he had, it's incredible how he handled it. And he always gave back. He's always generous to charities, always had time for kids. Because he went through a lot. He had difficulty going up because what's it called when you read backwards?
Dyslexic.
He was dyslexic. He went through a lot of hard times because of his limitations. So he's very sensitive to kids. And when all of a sudden becomes this hero, he was able to do a lot with by inspiring and making kids that used to feel like him feel great.
As I mentioned earlier, you're an actor, you sang in the show and on stage, you're an author, a director, but you're also an entrepreneur. And one of the issues that you're passionate to talk about is drowsy driving, which is just driving when you're sleepy. What's the story behind this passion?
Well, it's beyond drowsy driving.
Okay.
It's kids in college going to the hospitals because they have to stay up all night studying, and they overdose on caffeine or all these horrible energy things that are baloney, that lethal for you. And they're all ending up in the hospital. And exhaustion in America, people at their jobs, machine operators, doctors, nurses, people have to be sharp. Big problem. But it started with drowsy driving because years ago, I fell asleep. Mm. I was exhausted, blacked out. Thank God I didn't kill anybody or myself, but scared the heck out of me. And like I told you, my uncle was Dr. Henry Heimlich, creator of the Heimlich Maneuver. In fact, he and I got the Heimlich Maneuver on television, national television, for the first time on the Merv Griffin Show. And he told me, when I told him about it, he said, Anson, keep cut up lemons with you when you know you're going to be have an exhausted day. Hmm. And Henry is a genius in how the body works the body, almost a naturalist. He said it works because the citric acid and sour lemon will hit the lingual nerve in the middle of the top of your tongue. Mm. The automatic reflex reaction of the body is adrenaline. You're up. You're alert. Nothing in your system. It's like going to your doctor and they have the little rubber mallet and they check your reflexes, right?
Sure. Yeah, right.
Same thing with the tongue. There's a sensory reflex action between tongue and brain, and it's adrenaline. So you get this rush. You're up. You're alert. Nothing in your system. Nothing to hurt you, and it's instant. And I started doing that. I started cutting up lemons and never had the problem again. Well, then I went, you know, as an entrepreneur, I went into the product business and I love creating problem-solving products. Well, my business partner and I started researching drowsy driving. And everybody out there, this will save your life and a friend's life. This is important, really important. So listen to this. There are almost 200 million drowsy drivers a year. Mm-hmm. Should I repeat that? 1 out of 5 admit to falling asleep, so you know it's more. Number of deaths and tragedies are more, much more, than drunk and medicated driving combined. Should I say that again? Drunk and medicated driving combined are pale to drowsy driving. And the percentage of the deaths are not the drowsy driver. It's the innocent families he hits. So looking at this catastrophic problem in the country, right under guns, I mean, it's a major problem, not a minor problem. And no one talks about it. I agree not driving drunk is important, not taking narcotics is important, but this is even more important, and this we can solve. So I called up Dr. Heimlich. I had this idea. You know, after using the lemons for years, and it worked, I had this idea, and I called Dr. Heimlich. I said, listen, what if we created a spray drop, right amount of citric acid, right amount of sour lemon, little water, bit of preservative for shelf life, and what if we just had the spray that just spray drops whoop, right on top of your tongue? Hmm. He got excited. He said, oh my gosh, he said, that's more powerful than a lemon. It's a direct hit. You will save more lives than the Heimlich maneuver because there's more people exhausted and driving or college students than there are people choking. He said, promise me you'll do it. So we did, and with the help of Dr. Heimlich, we created Alert Drops, A-L-E-R-T, Alert Drops. And basically what it is, it's a super-powered lemon in a simple spray that you hit the top of your tongue, and trust me, you're whoop, up, alert, and you're not going to kill yourself. If people go to alertdrops.com, that's alertdrops.com, they can read all about it, see Dr. Heimlich's story, they can see the testimonials, and all the science behind it. We didn't invent, all we did was invent a better scooter. The science was done years ago by MIT and all these other places. This is just old knowledge and old science. We just figured out a way to make it civilized. And construction sites are buying it, doctors, schools. I mean, any place where alertness is paramount. Sporting teams are using it before games. My daughters use it for their soccer games. Already it's saved so many lives, and we've already been honored by the United States Congress, California State Senate, City of L.A., L.A. firefighters, police departments. But more importantly, it works, and it's important at all times. A month's worth in that spray is less than 1.5 cups of Starbucks coffee.
Okay.
So, again, you're saving lives. And what I tell people, too, is, listen, if you don't want to buy alert drops, that's fine. Then keep cut-up lemons in your car or with you, because that'll work, too. That'll work. A little messier, not quite as convenient, but it works. I just want people protected. I desperately, desperately want people protected. That, to me, is so much more important than stardom. If I could be like Dr. Heimlich and know people's lives were saved because I was here, and people's lives are going to continue to be saved after I'm gone, that's a legacy that's purposeful. That's meaningful. That's kind of a destined way of life. That would be my Academy Award.
Ensign, after you spray it, how long does it last? Do you keep spraying it for a while, or depending how long your drive is? How does that work, or how long does it stay in your system?
Well, everybody's body's different.
Sure.
We find an average of a spray or two on the tongue, which is a couple little sprays, lasts a half hour to an hour.
Okay.
And then if you need it again, you hit it again. You know, nothing's in your system. It's like, again, it's like just a reflex reaction, like the little rubber mallet.
Yeah.
All you're getting is like a natural adrenaline effect. That's it. But I don't recommend, I'm not going to sleep and I'm just going to drive 10 hours. That's not the purpose of it.
Right, right.
The purpose of it is to get you home if you're 10 minutes away, or get off the road before you kill somebody. That's the purpose of it. And the purpose of it for students, while they have to cram for hours and hours, they can do it. They're not hurting their system. They're not ruining their health. They're not screwing up their sleep pattern. The other thing is, when you take caffeine, it takes 20 minutes to take effect, especially driving, and that's too long, and you need too much of it.
Well, I'm going to give it a go. Every time I drive from San Diego, for some reason coming back home to the Inland Empire region, I always get sleepy. So now I tell my husband, you have to go with me because I always get sleepy on that drive. And so now I know what to give it a try.
Oh, you'll call and thank. You'll thank Dr. Heimlich. I mean, he's the genius behind it. He passed away a few years ago, but a couple of weeks before his passing was our last conversation, and he brought up, promised him we'd get this product out.
And you did.
Yes, so we did. And honestly, I wish, you are great. I wish the media was more helpful with this. They put on so much inquire state of mind junk that something so substantial, they make it very difficult to spread the word. You know, they really do.
Let me ask you, looking back on your career, which has been extensive, would you do anything differently, or did you play it just the way you did?
I thought I made a lot of mistakes. However, I think they were all maybe destined mistakes, because I wouldn't want to change who I am now. And who I am now is because of life experience. Sometimes you have to make the mountain a little harder to climb than it has to be. You make it harder on yourself to learn more.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been a delight. I so enjoyed my time with you.
Well, thank you, and thanks so much.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with actor, producer, author, entrepreneur, and more, Ensign Williams. I'm David Fleming. Before we close this edition of KVC Arts, let's go to Shireen Awad with a very special remembrance.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep.
On March 20th, the world lost a musical icon, singer and songwriter Kenny Rogers. Kenny Rogers was an award-winning musician and storyteller who topped both the country and pop charts with hits like The Gambler, Lucille, and Islands in the Stream, which he recorded with Dolly Parton. He grew up in Houston and was exposed to a broad range of musical genres, which reflected in his music. In 2013, Kenny Rogers was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, logging 20 number one hits on the country charts alone. Beyond music, Rogers was a philanthropist, photographer, actor, entrepreneur, and an author, writing a guide about how to break into the music business, a children's book, a photo collection of images he'd taken around the United States, alongside many other works. He sold more than 120 million copies of his dozens of albums worldwide during his career, making him one of the best-selling male artists of all time. After 6 decades of live performances, Kenny Rogers announced a long farewell tour in 2015 titled The Gambler's Last Deal, which was more than just a concert. It was a musical journey of his life, complete with all the hits and archive footage over his long career, and an opportunity to say goodbye to his fans one night, one city at a time. In 2018, he had to cut his final tour short, canceling the rest of his tour dates due to health reasons, but leaving his many fans around the world a lasting message. He said, "I've thoroughly enjoyed this opportunity to say farewell to the fans over the course of the past 2 years on the Gambler's Last Deal tour. I could never properly thank them for the encouragement and support they've given me throughout my career and the happiness I've experienced as a result of that." We remember Kenny Rogers as a country music legend with a soulful voice that will live on in the hearts of many.
And somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold. Know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. Sitting at the table, there'll be time enough to count when the deal is done.
That was KVCR's Shireen Awad with this very special memory and tribute for Kenny Rogers, who we lost just earlier this year. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Anson Williams and to Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with author Richard Lieberman. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR1, and Google Play, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.